anything definitive. I've been doing basically nothing for 9 months now, at least nothing of any real substance. I haven't been able to interview anyone. I haven't seen any of the FBI summaries, and the only matters I've seen are related to credit problems of low-level support staff. I'm not being used. They don't seek my advice. They don't even ask me to lecture the interns or the new staff on security. Do you think you're kept here just to maintain a false image of security? I asked, knowing the answer. George's complaints were familiar by now. George looked downcast. What else can I think? I don't know if Livingstone or Kennedy are even reading the FBI summaries, but I have to believe they are. You know, Craig complained to me that many staffers have got to be fired for serious character problems, but Kennedy won't do it. And Craig told me you guys don't even have the paperwork to do background investigations on staffers who have been here from the beginning. That's unbelievable. Yeah, but it was true. On 11 March 1994, Anne DeVroy of the Washington Post reported that a few White House staff members still did not have passes. In fact, hundreds still didn't have passes, and many had even avoided filling out the forms to enable an investigation. Dee Dee Myers, one of the worst offenders, was finally grilled by the White House press corps about the issue and had to admit her own delinquent status. Over the next several days, Dee Dee released additional facts about the security mess, probably intending to limit the shock at the extent of this national security disaster. Dee Dee was quick to assure the media that steps were being taken to clear up the problem. But there weren't any positive steps being taken. If anything, one could argue that things were getting worse, as official Clinton administration edicts about lifestyles and other issues inhibited our investigations. Lies like this passed easily from the lips of Clinton staffers. The great mystery to me was how anyone could still believe them. There were no hardball questions for Dee Dee, nor did the press follow up to see what steps the administration took to address the issue. On 23 March, Bill Kennedy was demoted by Lloyd Cutler. He was going to be the designated scapegoat for the disabled failed security program, even though he was just doing what he had been told to do. It was another twofer, because while Kennedy was no longer the gatekeeper in charge of vetting and backgrounding investigations, he could now spend 100% of his time on Hillary's Whitewater legal problems, filling a void left when Foster died. Kennedy was making $125,000 a year in taxpayer dollars, plus benefits. It was soon revealed, however, that Kennedy had legal problems of his own for failing to pay his full federal income taxes in 1991 and 1992. When he was first asked to come to the White House by Hillary Clinton and Vince Foster, Kennedy did repair some of his tax problems, but not all of them. Kennedy was another nanny-gator. Like so many of the Clintons' friends, the Kennedys were wealthy enough to have a nanny. They just didn't want to have to pay for her. Now, Kennedy had a new problem. His wife was leaving him. He was afraid that she would disclose his problems to the media, or that her allegations would show up in civil divorce proceedings. So he tried to quick fix his tax problems. Once again, however, like so many times before, Kennedy could not do it honestly, could not bring himself to be a straight. He structured his IRS payment so that it might be concealed from investigators. Kennedy told his estranged wife to write a check to pay for the missing tax money using her old checkbook and her former married name. Kennedy was making $600,000 a year in Little Rock and trying to save a couple thousand dollars at the nanny's expense. Until he was found out, he insisted he was entirely innocent. He told the media that his estranged wife occasionally liked to use her old married name, while at other times she used her maiden name. It was a whimsical thing, not an attempt to deceive. Right. When Kennedy was interviewed by Dennis, did he confess his federal tax dodging? Kennedy came to the White House shortly after the Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood debacles. He knew the potential impact that his own nanny-gate problems could have on the Clinton administration. When caught, Kennedy claimed that he had alerted his supervisor to his nanny-gate problem. Who was that supervisor? none other than the late Vince Foster. Kennedy, drowning in character problems of his own, was supposed to maintain standards at the White House and help vet various cabinet-level applicants. It was ludicrous. He had ignored the Secret Service, the FBI, and anyone else who had an interest in protecting President Clinton and national security. He had even ignored his own security director's pleas to take action. Now we know why. Kennedy himself was a security risk. In spite of claims that White House security was enhanced by the replacement of Kennedy with Beth Nolan, nothing much happened. After all, Nolan had been an attorney in the counsel's office from the beginning and had worked with Kennedy. In January 1993, she had met with Greg Walden, President Bush's ethics czar, and had learned all about the security system. She knew how it was supposed to run, and surely she must have seen how Kennedy was dismantling the system. I wondered if there had been a ceremony, a passing of the baton, with Kennedy carrying hundreds of unread, unadjudicated FBI case files that had been stacked up in a corner of his office over to a corner of her office, where they could be restacked, not to be disturbed until the Clinton Library would open years hence. There was no wholesale enhancement of security. How could there be? After all, hundreds of uncleared staff members had worked in the White House for more than a year. This was a staff composed of many who would never have been approved for a permanent pass in anyone else's White House. Now they were going to be dismissed? How could that possibly be accomplished without enormous disruption and embarrassment to the White House? Nobody was fired, except for poor single moms working in support positions who admitted they were behind in their rent payments. Firing them was George Saunders' job. A threefer. Fire the moms, give George something to do, and make everyone believe they were cleaning up the place. All the rest, the drug users, the tax scofflaws, the bankrupts, the liars, remained in. Except for this one famous guy named Watkins, who used the presidential helicopter as his personal golf cart. But then Watkins wasn't really fired. He was merely transferred down the street to become a highly paid consultant for the campaign to re-elect Bill and Hillary Clinton. Did some people with serious character problems leave? Sure. But not because of anything developed in any of my FBI investigations. They left because they chose to become lobbyists, or they were promoted, or they were tired, or they were just plain disgusted by what they themselves did or what they saw others doing. And if they left for that last reason, I knew exactly how they felt. On 24 January 1995, Dennis arrived looking gloomy. He had a hard time hiding his emotions. He jokingly chalked it up to being Italian. "What's up, buddy? You don't look like you're having a good day. What's happening? Go by the R.A.?" R.A. was short for Resident Agency, our Tyson's Corner office in Northern Virginia. "Yes, I did, and that was my big mistake. I got into an argument with Tom about conditions down here, and the fact that we aren't getting any backing from him." "Dennis, that's an old story. We've been on our own ever since Clinton took office. There hasn't been one debate, one issue, one fight that we've won." "Yeah, I know. I guess I just keep thinking that they'll get wise to what this administration is doing one of these days. The FBI that I know, the one I think I'm working for, wouldn't put up with this kind of thing, would they?" "You're asking me?" "Look, Tom Renegahan and Jim Bork pretty much control the spin process, and they seem to have little interest in anything but meeting deadlines. They don't care about anything else. It doesn't matter if a case is complex and we're turning up good stuff. They push to close the case to make the deadline. Even if we could convince Tom there's a big problem, he's only a supervisor. He wouldn't be able to change anything. As unit chief, Bork would step in and stop him. And don't forget the fact that they tried to set us up, pal." Making war with FBI headquarters unit chiefs was always a loser, even if you were totally right. Because the thinking was, if there is a good idea, we at FBI headquarters have already thought of it. And if something goes wrong, it must have happened out in the field. It couldn't possibly be FBI headquarters' fault. The Bureau wasn't much different from any other bureaucracy in that respect. We were top-heavy, and the heavies at the top had the power. Dennis, you're wasting too much time wishing that the FBI would rise to meet your expectations. The Bureau's changed. What doesn't change is the work we have to do. In our jobs, character still counts for something, even if President Clinton and his wife don't think so. Oh, yeah, sure. How does character count in our jobs if this administration has thrown character, standards, the law, everything out the window? Nobody cares. Gary, people higher up, people in Congress, I think they all know this is happening. Clinton's abolished security here for a whole year now, and the Secret Service, the FBI, the military, Congress, nobody's willing to challenge the way the Clintons are staffing the government or endangering national security. I mean, this whole Inman case is typical of how screwed up things still are. I had to agree. Admiral Bobby Inman had been announced to replace the stumbling, bumbling Les Aspin as Secretary of Defense on 16 December 1993. Thanks to the abysmal vetting by the Clintons and their staff, exactly 1 month later the President announced that Inman was withdrawing his name from consideration. There seemed to be issues in his past, you see. Look, Dennis, why don't you take the rest of the day off? Believe me, the Clintons will never notice you aren't here trying to protect them or national security. They don't seem to care, so why do you? Gary, you're absolutely right. I'm the fool for thinking that this garbage is important. Damn it, I'm going on leave, if anyone cares. Come on, buddy, you just need a break. I'll call the office and have you put on leave. How's that? Dennis thanked me, closed his briefcase, and walked out the door. It was about 1 p.m. At about 5 p.m., I was standing in the snow at the Fairfax Hospital Trauma Unit helicopter pad as the chopper carrying Dennis gently set down. I had gone out to the RA to deliver some reports, as Dennis could not do it for me. And between the time I left the White House and arrived at the RA, a call had come in from the Manassas Airport Security Office, wanting to know if we had a Dennis Scuolimbrini working for us. They had found him underneath the front of his Cessna airplane, with the back of his head crushed in, the apparent victim of a freak accident caused when the engine of his plane backfired as he was trying to turn the prop by hand. Dennis was airlifted by a Life Flight helicopter to the country's best trauma unit. I didn't know if Dennis was alive or dead, but I rushed to the hospital to assist him and his family if I could. I was the first to get there, but soon several other members of the spin squad rolled up. We got on the phones to notify Dennis's friends and relatives. Greg Schwartz, the agent who had been shunned and kicked out of the vice president's office, brought Dennis's wife Katie to the hospital. We were by the hospital door as they wheeled Dennis in, and in spite of the tremendous blow he had received, it had broken his skull and driven pieces of it into his brain, he was conscious. We misinterpreted this to mean that he would be all right. They wheeled him into an MRI and then right into surgery. At about 1 a.m., the surgeon came out with the good news, bad news. Dennis was alive, but just barely. He was in a coma. The doctor had to remove a small portion of the back of his brain that had been damaged by the blow and was full of skull fragments. The doctor said that if he was alive in the morning, then maybe he would make it. But the doctor could not predict exactly what Dennis would be like if he survived. I stayed with his wife until the rest of the family arrived. Thankfully, our supervisor, Tom Renegahan, who couldn't seem to help us with our problems at the White House, was a great comfort at this tragedy. Indeed, the goodness of the FBI came through in full force, with FBI Director Louis Free and Assistant Director Anthony Daniels joining us at the hospital. Unlimited support was given to Dennis and his family as we all waited to see if he could survive. He did, and he returned to the White House, still doing the work of two agents, but without his sense of taste, the loss of which has been somewhat helpful, all things considered. But on that day in January, I lost my buddy, my sounding board, and it got mighty lonely for me at the Clinton White House. Agents were sent down to fill in for Dennis. They needed three. But when they questioned me about how the Clinton White House worked, I didn't feel like trying to catch them up on how things didn't work. My mind was on Dennis. The Clinton administration was irrelevant. We had tried to alert the powers that be to the White House's dismantled security, and we had failed in our attempt to fix it. Our job was done. The problem belonged to someone else. Chapter 11, the last chapter, and the beat goes on. Rules for Radicals. Our rebels have contemptuously rejected the values and way of life of the middle class. They have stigmatized it as materialistic, decadent, bourgeois, degenerate, imperialistic, warmongering, brutalized, and corrupt. They are right. George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. Labor to keep alive in your breast that little celestial fire called conscience. I'd had enough. Not only would I leave the White House, but I decided to retire early from the FBI. Still, it was no easy slide to June 1995, to coffee, donuts, a gold pin, and a congratulatory letter signed by Director Free. No, it had to be tough right up to the end. In early December 1994, President Clinton announced that outgoing Congressman Dan Glickman would replace Mike Espy as Secretary of Agriculture. At a Rose Garden ceremony to make the announcement formal, the president gave Espy credit for doing a superb job and for taking charge to implement major reforms. The president didn't mention that Espy's idea of taking charge included an apparent weakness for taking things that didn't belong to him. Espy was under criminal investigation for wrongdoing while in a cabinet position. The FBI had yet to begin its background investigation into Congressman Glickman, but already congressmen from both parties, including the new Republican majority, stepped forward to praise him. Again, it seemed as though our investigation would be superfluous. Special Agent Tim Traylor visited Glickman's residence for the usual formal interview. It was a mid-morning, workday appointment. He was greeted at the door by an unshaven, sleepy-eyed, bathrobed Glickman, a halo of powdered donut crumbs around his mouth. Traylor said that Glickman seemed surprised, looked at his watch, and said, "Oh yeah, the FBI thing. I forgot about that." Between chews and swallows, Glickman invited Agent Traylor in, his slippers clip-clopping as he led him to the kitchen. Traylor was appalled at Glickman's lack of professionalism, which was ironic, because Agent Traylor was one of the last to condemn the administration. Unlike most agents, Traylor was vocal about his politics and loudly proclaimed his support for Clinton and the Democratic Party. But even Tim had come to believe that the FBI was no longer being used to screen appointees who would be granted enormous power, great benefits, and a big salary. We merely provided political cover. While Traylor investigated Glickman's neighborhood, Special Agent Greg Schwartz investigated through his connections on the Senate side, and I handled the House side. Privacy Act provisions prevent me from providing details about Congressman Glickman's background investigation. But news accounts, mostly generated by the White House, claimed that Senate confirmation hearings for a well-scrubbed Glickman were being held up by the FBI spin process. This delay came at a bad time for the Clintons. Henry Foster, the Clintons' nominee to replace Jocelyn Elders as Surgeon General, was under heavy fire for lying about the number of abortions he had performed. Was it 2, 20, or 700? The Clintons might believe that truth is relative, but some people keep records, and FBI agents can read and add. The Foster nomination was in serious trouble, and he soon became another victim of a thorough FBI spin investigation that somebody actually read. When Glickman's case wasn't finished in the usual 30 days because of serious questions that needed answers, the White House pressured the FBI to complete the probe. Calls were placed several times a day by the White House counsel's office asking why the Glickman case was not finished. About this time, Security Director Livingstone, who must have read my Glickman reports or heard about them, stopped being friendly. I guess I wasn't going to be the Clinton security consultant after all. The FBI, feeling the heat, forced us to spend more and more time explaining why we needed to continue the investigation, and less time actually investigating. The supervisor of our squad began calling us into his office for conferences. He asked us to explain every action we took, to justify each interview, to prove the necessity of finding all the documents we sought to examine. Soon the conferences turned into major arguments, and on more than one occasion the four of us, three senior agents and one bureaucrat, stood nose to nose in a circle shouting. One of us, not me, threatened to go to the Washington Post if the pressure from the White House didn't stop. The FBI insisted we close the Glickman case, but we didn't budge. I told my supervisor to order me on paper to cease my investigation or shut up. I knew full well that he would never officially command me to close a complex investigation with a written order that would make him responsible if things went wrong. I also knew that if the serious questions about Glickman were not resolved, we might see yet another independent counsel appointed, costing millions of dollars and further tarnishing the presidency. If we proved Glickman to be honest and ethical, the FBI spin would document that. If we found problems, the White House and the Senate would be responsible for going forward, not the FBI. What we couldn't do, ethically or professionally, was submit a half-completed report just to get the White House and FBI management off our backs. Meanwhile, the media began its own investigation and reported that there were some questions about bad checks Glickman had written on the House bank and about dependents of Glickman using congressional credit cards. The media unearthed that Glickman, a millionaire whose wife worked for Congress as chairperson of the Arts Subcommittee, was alleged to have misused congressional funds for personal business. There was some talk of traffic tickets. More shocking were reports that Glickman's administrative assistant had committed suicide, but not before accusing him in writing of misuse of funds. She left instructions to submit these allegations to the House Ethics Committee in the event of her death. The House Ethics Committee, however, apparently took no action. Nevertheless, the Senate, the Republican Senate, stood by its former congressional colleague and confirmed Glickman the day before April Fool's Day by a vote of 94-0. I felt the world had been turned upside down. I was disgusted and disheartened. But fate wasn't done with me yet. Next in my box was the Anthony Coelho investigation. It was then I realized, too late, that Buzzard's Point hadn't been so bad after all. Again, the Privacy Act will not allow a disclosure of anything from Coelho's spin, but there is a phone book-thick collection of media reports on the antics of Coelho that would keep any investigator busy for a long, long time. On the heels of the Aldrich Ames spy case, the Clintons announced a presidential commission to study roles and capabilities of the intelligence community, and to recommend fundamental changes for the CIA, the FBI, and other agencies. The members of the commission would need to know the most secret activities of the most secret agencies in order to perform their function. So it was vital that all members of this important commission be of the highest caliber and have spotless backgrounds. Departing Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, appointed former Congressman Tony Coelho to the commission. He was an odd choice. Coelho had left Congress under a cloud and had gone to New York and made millions in the commodities markets. He had also taken a presidential appointment to a commission on the handicapped. Coelho's handicap? He had epilepsy, acquired in his youth from head injuries when a pickup truck he was in flipped over. To control his mental and emotional handicap, Coelho reportedly received a daily dose of a downer called methaqualone, or Quaalude. This drug, known to most boomers as Ludes, has the effect of producing a feeling of inner peace while removing all normal inhibitions. It's the drug of choice for seducers, or those who want to be seduced. What effect would such a drug, taken daily, have on a man with extraordinary access to our nation's most carefully guarded secrets? A man expected to make sober and reasoned decisions. It was a fair question. Would we now grant security clearances to persons whose minds were chemically altered, even for alleged medical reasons? Tony Coelho was nothing if not an interesting character. He had been in so much trouble as a congressman that more than one book and many articles had been written about him. He had been the subject of several, albeit unsuccessful, federal criminal probes. Hiring Coelho to serve on the Intelligence Commission was taking the protection of national security to a new low. The Coelho investigation was received on 7 March 1995. It was to be completed by 27 March without fail. To order that we finish this investigation in what amounted to 15 working days was an outrage and impossible, and that's what I advised my supervisor in writing the very day I got the assignment. I made sure that he, in the presence of witnesses, acknowledged the receipt of my memorandum. It would be too easy to throw my memo in the round file. It had been done before. I kept a copy for my own protection. But he still harangued me with calls to meet the deadline. When the deadline passed, I let his increasingly panicked calls go directly to the message machine, and I turned off my beeper, which was going off so often I couldn't keep fresh batteries in it. The FBI spin management knew I was investigating serious allegations. But their attitude seemed to be, "Yes, yes, Gary, we know about that, but what about the deadline?" As far as I was concerned, the deadline would have to wait. Among the allegations against Coelho, some of which he freely confessed, were the following. Taking daily doses of methaqualone or phenobarbital for medical reasons. Prior alcoholism and considerations of suicide. Illegal, unethical, or inappropriate lobbying of the new Clinton administration. Potential conflicts of interest. Resigning from Congress on 15 June 1989 after multiple accusations of serious wrongdoing, including violations of federal laws. Failing to correctly report income on a federal income tax return. Failing to report a loan of $50,000 in violation of House ethics reporting requirements. Issuing in less than 1 year 316 personal checks for a total of more than $293,000, all drawn on a bank account for which there were insufficient funds. Accepting a sweetheart junk bond deal from Michael Milken, later convicted and sentenced by U.S. federal judge Kimba Wood. Accepting a $4,000 gift from a savings and loan banker, later indicted and convicted of federal violations. Using inappropriate influence to protect owners of failing savings and loans. Accepting illegal political contributions aboard a 112-foot yacht owned by a savings and loan businessman who was later indicted and convicted of fraud. Improperly appointing a friend and large contributor to the finance chair of the DNC. The friend owned a failing Texas savings and loan. Apparent false statements made to a current employer regarding pending criminal investigations. Coelho allegedly told his new employer that an investigation into his activities while a congressman was over. In fact, that investigation continued for 3 more years. Alleged improper contacts with employees of the Clinton Department of Agriculture for the purpose of influencing decisions made with respect to farm chemicals being produced by a leading manufacturer, also a big contributor to politicians. This list is by no means complete. These are just some of the public, media-reported allegations against Coelho, most of which have never been investigated fully for one reason or another. Now, there was a reason to fully investigate these allegations, but I wasn't being allowed to. While it was true that Coelho was never convicted of any crime, the Department of Justice Office of Public Integrity only declined to prosecute him, and anyone in law enforcement and the political arena knows that declining to prosecute is not the same as declaring someone innocent. The deeper I dug, the more cynical were the questions I posed to myself. How much were Coelho's chances for an important position enhanced by the fact that he was engaged in fundraising for the president's defense against the sexual harassment lawsuit brought by Paula Jones? Could Coelho's opportunity to join the commission have anything to do with the fact that he defended Hillary Clinton's celebrated windfall profits in cattle futures? What about the public speculation that the Clintons wanted Coelho cleared to work on the commission in order to rehabilitate him so he could run the president's reelection campaign? I was not in charge of standards, nor was I in charge of the Coelho investigation. I was just asking questions. And I was only the lead agent covering the U.S. House of Representatives. Ultimately, Coelho got his security clearance from the Clinton administration and gained access to some of the most sensitive information our government has. If you ask me why, I don't know. At the end of my assignment at the White House, I concluded that the Clintons might as well hitch a trailer to the White House and tow it to Little Rock. They had soiled the place. The U.S. Park Service hedge clipper in the Rose Garden had a finer character than the President of the United States. The sad thing was, the clipper knew it. On my last day, I took one last stroll around the White House. I walked past the Rose Garden. As the Park Service employee clipped a hedge in front of the Oval Office, glancing occasionally at the man who was sitting behind the big desk, I wondered what might be going through the hedge clipper's mind. I think I know, because so many of the permanent employees were thinking the same thing. There's been a big mistake, a whopper of a mistake. How the heck did it happen, and what the heck are we going to do about it now? Epilogue. The Spin Background Investigation of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Clinton is an unusually good liar. Unusually good. Do you realize that? Bob Kerry, U.S. Senator, Democrat, Nebraska, as quoted in Esquire, January 1996. The only people at the White House not required to have extensive background investigations conducted by the FBI are the President and Vice President and their immediate families. And yet, perhaps under certain circumstances, they are the ones who need a proper vetting most of all. Presented below is a facsimile of the background investigation summary that I would have prepared on the Clintons and presented to the public if that had been part of my official duties at the White House. All of the information contained herein has been compiled from public documents, newspapers, magazines, and books, with the exception of the exhibits at the end, which are the result of personal investigations conducted since I left the FBI. When I note that the Clintons have refused to release certain records, this is information that has been requested by the media or by other public bodies. Special Inquiry Summary Report, 15 April, 1996. Introduction. The candidates under investigation are Bill and Hillary Clinton. They have both indicated an interest in continuing to be employed by the federal government and have stated that they believe they are suitable and meet all official requirements for such employment. What follows is an investigative summary and attachments so that an adjudicator can make an informed decision on whether their employment and access to the White House and the executive branch should be continued. Mr. Clinton's education. William Jefferson Blythe Clinton, a.k.a. Bill, is a white male, aged 49, born 8-19-46 in Hope, Arkansas. It is reported that he graduated from Hot Springs High School, Hot Springs, Arkansas, in 1964. While attending high school, Mr. Clinton ran for class secretary and lost. It is reported that after graduation, Mr. Clinton attended Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and graduated in 1968. It is reported that while at Georgetown, Mr. Clinton was very active in campus politics. It is noted that Mr. Clinton has refused to allow a review of any disciplinary records at Georgetown and has also refused to supply any records related to his attendance or performance as a student while attending classes there. A degree is claimed by Mr. Clinton, but the investigator has not personally seen a copy, and no objective assessment of his performance as a student while at Georgetown could be established. The investigation of this period of the candidate's life could not be completed due to the failure of the candidate to cooperate in making such records available. In 1968, Mr. Clinton was selected as a Rhodes candidate and was given a scholarship to attend Oxford University in Oxford, England. Mr. Clinton's selection cannot be taken as evidence of outstanding or unique ability. It has been reported that at the time he was selected, there was little, if any, real competition in the state of Arkansas for this vacancy, which in that state at that time was often determined as much by political connections as by scholarship. It appears from documents, various interviews, and his own words that he attended Oxford for one full year only and took no degree. There are no records to support a claim that he registered or attended any classes during his second term. Instead, it appears that Mr. Clinton lived with various friends on or near the Oxford campus and spent his time involved in various anti-U.S. and anti-Vietnam War activities. Investigation reveals that after the winter of 1969, Mr. Clinton embarked on a tour of Europe, and there are suggestions that school officials told Mr. Clinton that he was no longer welcome on campus, but that could not be confirmed. Various friends and classmates of Mr. Clinton, however, have reported that he was uninterested in study and was a lackluster student. Investigation has determined that when Mr. Clinton returned to Oxford after the first year, he crashed with various friends and was described as a moocher who never paid for anything and never seemed to have any money to share or to contribute to the cost of his own subsistence. During Mr. Clinton's attendance at Oxford and his subsequent trips around Europe and Asia, he had no apparent source of income aside from his scholarship, and it is unknown how this tour was funded. However, it has been established that he served as a quasi-ambassador for a leftist organization in Washington, D.C., known as Vietnam Moratorium Committee, or VMC, an organization founded by one Sam Brown, among others. It appears that Mr. Clinton's sole purpose at Oxford in the fall of 1969 was to organize student protests against the United States for the VMC. There were no grades available for review to prove or disprove claims regarding Clinton's achievement, since the university will not release such records absent the candidate's authority. It is noted that normally a candidate would sign a release so as to allow investigators to confirm or deny educational claims. In this case, the candidate will neither sign a release form nor will he provide documentation related to his attendance and performance at Oxford. This failure to supply needed documentation is a significant failure to cooperate on the part of the candidate, since much of his claim of suitability is pinned to his educational opportunities and experiences. After his tour of Europe, Mr. Clinton returned to his mother's home in Arkansas before leaving for Yale Law School. Mr. Clinton attended Yale Law School from 1970 to 1973, at which time it is reported that he graduated with a degree in law. Again, no records are available to confirm or deny his performance at the law school. It is noted, however, that even if the candidate had signed a release form allowing a review of his transcripts, there would not be the usual information available to determine his grade point average. Yale, at that time, had capitulated to student protests demanding a pass-fail system. One student who attended with Mr. Clinton said of the grading system, "You really had to work hard to flunk out." There is also some indication that Mr. Clinton was again uninterested in study. In one class that Mr. Clinton attended with his future wife, it was reported that Mr. Clinton's performance was considered mediocre, whereas Hillary Rodham's was impressive. Mr. Clinton received course credit for spending a semester working on the presidential campaign of Senator George McGovern. Mr. Clinton did not, however, work as a paralegal or as an assistant to a lawyer on the campaign. In summary, judging Mr. Clinton's academic performance would be highly speculative because of the absence of objective records available to the public. There have been claims that Mr. Clinton is highly intelligent or brilliant, but no testing data have been made available to substantiate these claims. He has attended prestigious institutions, though investigation has revealed that Mr. Clinton had important political sponsors who may have helped sway admissions boards, And again, absent any objective criteria being made available, measures of Mr. Clinton's intellectual achievements are speculative. With regard to personal conduct, no information has been made available by the candidate regarding his conduct while attending Georgetown, Oxford, or Yale. Mr. Clinton's financial standing during this time is also a matter of conjecture. It has been reported that his family was of modest means. Nevertheless, aside from his Rhodes Scholarship and work on the McGovern campaign and other political activities, there is no record of student employment, loans, or grants. If such loans were made, there is no way to determine if they have been repaid, as the candidate has failed to sign the proper waiver to determine if he obtained student loans. It is recommended that additional attempts be made to obtain the necessary records and waivers from Mr. Clinton, since the absence of this basic information prevents the completion of this part of the character inquiry and precludes the final determination of suitability, at least with respect to the educational component of this background investigation. Mr. Clinton's neighborhoods. The scope of this inquiry includes only the adult years of Mr. Clinton. At the time of his graduation from Hot Springs High School, he was living with his mother in Hot Springs, Arkansas. During the times he attended Georgetown, Oxford, and Yale, he lived on campus or with fellow students in apartments they had secured. There is, however, no documentary evidence that Mr. Clinton ever secured a place of residence on his own behalf. At Yale, Mr. Clinton lived in an off-campus apartment with his future bride, Hillary Rodham. It is reported that Rodham made the arrangements to secure the apartment. There is no known documentation that Mr. Clinton signed a residential rental agreement. Therefore, it is impossible to determine if he lived up to financial obligations during the years he was attending college. This was a 9-year period from 1964 to 1973. When Mr. Clinton was not attending college, he lived with his mother. One determination of suitability would be the review of police blotters in the areas where Mr. Clinton resided. Since police records are normally not available to the general public, and since Mr. Clinton has not allowed a review of law enforcement agencies, only neighborhood folklore about the candidate has been available, and no arrests of the candidate are reported. Mr. Clinton's neighbors described him as outgoing and gregarious, but report that while living with his mother, the candidate was subjected to a dysfunctional family experience. Mr. Clinton himself has described his stepfather as abusive and has related a history of his stepfather's alcoholism, spousal abuse, aggressive and hostile behavior, and womanizing. Mr. Clinton's stepfather reportedly fired a pistol at Mrs. Clinton on one occasion, hitting a lamp instead. There is no evidence that the police were called regarding this incident, although it is conceivable that had they been called, Mr. Clinton's stepfather could have been charged with attempted murder or aggravated assault, in addition to the obvious firearms charges. After marriage to Hillary Rodham, Mr. Clinton lived for a short period in a rented residence. With the exception of one other residence, Mr. Clinton has lived in housing provided by state or federal governments. As governor of the state of Arkansas for 12 years, Mr. Clinton lived in the Arkansas State Mansion, rent-free. From 1993 to the present time, Mr. Clinton, as president, has lived in the White House. At both locations, except for insignificant, largely symbolic sums paid by Mr. Clinton for purely personal items, all food, services, and transportation for Mr. Clinton and his family have been borne by some government agency. Therefore, it is virtually impossible to determine if Mr. Clinton is financially responsible, using the traditional definition of the term. In both locations, state and federal agencies provided the accountants and record-keeping to determine whether or not Mr. Clinton owes the government minor sums for purely personal needs. These government employees would know if Mr. Clinton had paid these sums. Their interviews, however, have not been permitted under the umbrella of security concerns. It is noted that these sums, if any, are minor in nature. Mrs. Clinton's education. Hillary Diane Rodham was born 10-26-47 in Chicago, Illinois, and was raised in the Chicago area. She was described as very active in high school and a high achiever. She graduated from Maine Township High School in 1965 and in the fall began attending Wellesley College. While in high school, she displayed a tendency to speak at inappropriate times and behaved in an irreverent manner during serious moments, often causing her teacher to scold her or send her to stand in the hall. During one incident, while her teacher was playing a recorded speech by General Douglas MacArthur, she and a classmate mocked the general, which was disruptive to the classroom. She was reportedly read the riot act by her unamused and disappointed teacher. Her high school classmates voted Mrs. Clinton most likely to succeed. At Wellesley, it appears from all information available that Mrs. Clinton was a serious student. There are, however, no claims that she exhibited brilliance. Mrs. Clinton has never allowed any examination of her educational records, academic or disciplinary. Therefore, no objective determination can be made as to her academic achievement or citizenship while attending Wellesley. It has been noted that in her second year she became active in student causes and became known as a campus activist. There is no evidence that these activities hampered her studies. Still, given that campus activism and campus unrest in the 1960s often involved serious acts of destruction and illegal activity, it would be important to determine if Mrs. Clinton was the subject of any disciplinary action by the college or came to the attention of nearby police agencies. Mrs. Clinton was elected student government president and was allowed to give a commencement address after allegedly twisting the arm of the president of Wellesley College. The Wellesley president reportedly told others that she did not think it was such a good idea for Mrs. Clinton to participate in the ceremony. Mrs. Clinton allegedly embarrassed a senior U.S. senator, a black Republican, who had spoken before her, with a mocking, insulting, and disrespectful retort to the senator's speech. This act won Mrs. Clinton a certain notoriety, and she appeared on the cover of Life magazine as a representative of college radicalism. Mrs. Clinton went on to attend Yale Law School and worked on George McGovern's presidential campaign, an activity for which she received course credit. Grades and other records are unavailable for Mrs. Clinton because of Yale's pass-fail grading system and her unwillingness to allow public scrutiny. Some individuals who knew both Mr. and Mrs. Clinton at that time suggest that of the two, Mrs. Clinton was the better law student, showing more interest and ability than Mr. Clinton. She was not, however, described as an outstanding student. With respect to financial issues, it appears that her family would have had the financial resources to send Mrs. Clinton to Wellesley and Yale. Mrs. Clinton's neighborhood. Insufficient information exists to document Mrs. Clinton's early neighborhood experiences. However, from statements made by her and others, she was not well liked as a child. Mrs. Clinton has complained of other children taunting and physically assaulting her. There is no evidence that Mrs. Clinton's family lived on the rough side of town, and no satisfactory explanation has been offered for why she was singled out for such abuse. But apparently Mrs. Clinton remembers this period of her life with clarity and anger. Mrs. Clinton's book, It Takes a Village, also hints at familial unhappiness, with passages like this one. Ask those who grew up in the picture-perfect houses about the secrets and desperation they sometimes concealed. Mrs. Clinton does not identify what secrets or desperation she is talking about. Mrs. Clinton's childhood experiences bear on this inquiry only insofar as they reveal themselves in emotional distress today. Reports of Mrs. Clinton's frequently explosive temper and domineering attitudes may be evidence of such distress, but they are a matter for further investigation by a trained psychologist. Mr. Clinton's pre-White House employment. Mr. Clinton has been involved in politics and political campaigns for many years. Mr. Clinton assisted in various political campaigns in his youth, which might be considered part-time employment. For a short period, while attending Georgetown, he was a student intern with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. On the George McGovern presidential campaign, Mr. Clinton was alleged to be poorly organized and a poor manager who effectively cost the senator votes. In a lesser-known political campaign, Mr. Clinton acted as a driver. Mr. Clinton was fired, however, for driving erratically, arriving late to events, and parking the car illegally, causing his candidate significant embarrassment. Through his political connections, Mr. Clinton was once invited to join Senior Senator William Fulbright for lunch in the Senate dining room. Mr. Clinton arrived so inappropriately dressed and groomed that the senator refused to dine with him and turned him away. After returning to Little Rock, Arkansas, upon graduation from Yale Law School, Mr. Clinton was given an assistant professorship at the University of Arkansas School of Law. In 1976, Mr. Clinton was elected Attorney General of Arkansas. In 1978, he was elected governor. It is noted that there exists a wealth of information related to Mr. Clinton's performance in these state positions. His ability as governor for the state of Arkansas is in dispute, with supporters claiming that much was accomplished and detractors stating he achieved nothing of much consequence. The one issue most closely linked to Mr. Clinton's 12 years as governor is education reform. Examination reveals, however, that Mr. Clinton delegated these efforts to Mrs. Clinton, who was given the task of raising Arkansas's education standards to the level of its neighboring states, which are Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Missouri, Tennessee, and Mississippi. Arkansas has approximately 2.5 million residents, making it smaller in population than metropolitan Washington, D.C. There are several serious allegations that have not been fully investigated and are still pending related to then-Governor Clinton's professional and personal behavior, including allegations that he abused and misused state assets and personnel. In several documented incidents, Mr. Clinton used personnel for activities which could only be defined as purely personal, and used state employees to assist him in engaging in illicit sexual conduct. In addition, Mr. Clinton is alleged to have paid off female companions who provided sexual favors by giving them state jobs. One major issue yet to be resolved is the allegation that Mr. Clinton sexually harassed one young lady and, when rebuffed, exposed his genitals to her. Mr. Clinton is currently being sued by this young lady and is expected to testify on this matter in the near future. There is no record to indicate that Mr. Clinton was ever investigated by local police officials about this alleged incident, which would normally be considered a felonious sexual assault. It should be noted that persistent rumors, many aired in admittedly politically prejudiced books and videos, attempt to connect Mr. Clinton not only with drug use, but even with drug running on a major scale through operations allegedly run out of Mena, Arkansas. Evidence to support these allegations rests heavily on the numerous Clinton aides, friends, and associates who committed suicide or died in accidents during his 12 years as governor. The only hard evidence, however, are the arrests and convictions of Mr. Clinton's half-brother and Mr. Clinton's closest political friend, Dan Lassiter, on felony drug charges involving cocaine. Investigation has determined the Clintons made many serious enemies while serving the state of Arkansas, but both profess innocence and appear baffled when asked why their enemies' hatred, as it has often been described, is so intense. Mr. Clinton has been interviewed several times regarding this phenomenon and has been asked to explain how he amassed so many dedicated enemies. He was unable to explain, stating that people either hate me or love me. There seems to be no in-between. So much has been publicly documented regarding Mr. Clinton's employment in Arkansas that no further investigation of this period was deemed warranted. There are many issues related to financial matters of which he was a party, but these matters were seemingly initiated by Mrs. Clinton, with Mr. Clinton acting in passive roles. It is true that Mr. Clinton received some financial benefit and suffered financial exposure as a result of Mrs. Clinton's activities. Mrs. Clinton's pre-White House employment. As a law student, Mrs. Clinton was a summer intern at a West Coast law firm that was involved in attempting to free jailed members of the Black Panther terrorist organization. Mrs. Clinton also worked on the George McGovern presidential campaign. After graduating from Yale, Mrs. Clinton was hired as an attorney on the committee to impeach President Richard Nixon. Mrs. Clinton later moved to Little Rock to marry Mr. Clinton and took a position as an associate in the Rose Law Firm. When Mr. Clinton was elected governor,